This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There's a lot to talk about today. Thank you for tuning in. You've seen them, those clusters of tents around Seattle. The city is considering giving more protections to the people living in those unauthorized homeless camps. Josh Feit is politics editor at Seattle Met and editor of the Met's politics blog, Publicola. He told me this legislation would make some big changes, including giving campers more warning before they're kicked out.
They'd have to give 30-day notice instead of 72 hours notice. They'd have to find housing for people to move them. They'd also have to provide an alternate site. If it's an unsafe or hazardous site, it's a shorter warning period, but they'd have to provide access to bathrooms. They'd have to give the residents of the homeless encampment an opportunity to fix what was unsafe about it, and they'd also have to find a nearby site.
Remind us what led to this. Why do proponents say the city needs to change the way it clears out encampments like this?
Look, there's just a lot of controversy about what are known as sweeps. I think we all saw the Seattle Times article that showed that it was just upending people's lives, separating them from their belongings. And I think the proponent's essential argument is that the current policy is simply chasing homeless people from spot to spot and actually exacerbating the public safety problem that the opponents of this council legislation cite.
Yes, we have a little audio from the city council meeting. This is Susan Russell supporting this legislation. She has been homeless on Seattle streets, and she said it's rough on everybody when you've got nowhere to go to the bathroom, nowhere to put your trash, but you can't just chase people away.
People are not garbage. They should not be swept. We need a safety net, okay? Tent encampments are a safety net. They cannot be swept. When you sweep people from one place to the next, that puts them behind, and they cannot get their services. It puts them backwards.
That's a great summary of the proponents of this new legislation, their argument. And their poster, the placard they had at the hearing yesterday was, sweep trash, not people, and essentially getting down to the kind of civil rights aspect of homeless people, that homeless people are people, and this sort of attempt to marginalize them more, again, exacerbates the problem of homelessness without getting to the root causes. And I think the clip you just played made that clear, that they feel that there are root causes, and that's what needs to be addressed instead of just sweeping homeless people from spot to spot.
This city council meeting was, you described it as raucous. This is Jennifer telling city council members that they would be crazy to put these new rules into effect.
Since when did the city of Seattle become a maid service? We have laws in place to ensure clean spaces for all citizens of Seattle. However, those squatting outside seem to be exempt from those laws. If you all allow this legislation as it is written to become an ordinance, it will confirm that you all as a collective body have lost your minds.
So dramatic stuff. You know, the point that the opponents of this legislation are making is that Tim Burgess, who was the lone council member to vote against it, seconded this from the dais, that they're somehow going to establish a right in the city to camp wherever you want. You know, that aspect of it isn't true. The proposed legislation, which comes from the ACLU and Columbia Legal Services and Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness, does identify spots that if they're unsafe, unsuitable, which means that they are designated for public uses, that no, people do not have an absolute right to be there, and the city can remove them. I would say additionally this issue of crime, I mean, crimes are illegal, correct? And so the city already has the power to stop people from committing crimes. However, there is a concern amongst people, groups who, you know, feel that they're if the city's hands are tied, and some of the city directors have sent a letter saying they think this will make it too cumbersome to remove some hazardous sites, that there will be a public safety concern. So that's the other side of the issue.
We expect people to disagree about a difficult issue. Was it just that, or Josh, are you detecting a real escalating tension in this town?
You know, this issue has obviously touched into a lot of other issues about explosive growth in this city and housing affordability or unaffordability. And so, yes, I think the city is really at loggerheads about what to do about growth, what to do about homelessness, how to deal with this tragedy. And what you saw yesterday, both sides, very animated. The folks who are upset that they felt the city's hands are being tied feel like they're being confronted with crime. And then the proponents of this legislation really kind of see it as a civil rights issue for homeless people, and they get very upset that the council is kind of marginalizing, oppressing homeless people, making the problem worse. I do think some of the best testimony came yesterday from a longtime public defender, Lisa Dogard, who when she gave her testimony, stood up, she held a sign from the opponents and a sign from the proponents. Together, and they literally overlapped as she held them. And she described that, look, you're creating a false dichotomy by pitting these two issues against each other. They go hand in hand. And she made the point again that the sweeps actually exacerbate the public safety issue.
That's Josh Feit, politics editor at Seattle Met and editor of the Met's politics blog, Publicola. Feit told me he's going to be watching to see whether the legislation stays as it is or whether the city council waters it down to please the mayor's office. We'll keep following all of this for you right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.
Merhaban.
Ni hao.
Hello.
Bonjour.
Namaste.
Yesu.
Hey.
Ciao.
Hello.
And we continue now with our series Upon Arrival about new refugees in the Seattle area. This is a hot button topic in this election year with a migration crisis overseas. Yesterday, we introduced you to a couple from Iran who need jobs right away to keep their apartment. When we left off, they had recently heard some big news that will change their plans. KUOW's Liz Jones picks up from there.
It's 4 months since Netta and Payman arrived as refugees. They're at a doctor's appointment and let me tag along.
I want to feel your tummy, okay?
The doctor pulls out a tape measure.
You're 21 weeks. Some people don't start feeling the baby until they're 22 weeks.
Yep, there's a baby on the way.
Good? Okay, we'll see you next month, okay?
Thank you.
If you need anything, you know where we are, okay?
As we walk out, Payman, in his playful way, leans over Netta's shoulders and practices for the big day.
Netta, I'm here. Don't worry, I'm here.
This baby lights them up with joy, and also with an urgency to get some things in order. Their first months did not go exactly as planned. Rent is higher than expected, and they hoped for jobs right away. In Iran, Netta was a pastry chef, and Payman set up telecom networks. But here, it took 3 months just to get social security cards, something most employers want to see. Payman was stressed, but tried to keep up Netta's spirits. This journey had been hard on her. She cried a lot. Then, a couple weeks back, they turned a major corner. They both landed their first jobs at one of the most all-American places around.
So up here, you see the orders come in.
McNuggets and one McDeacon.
McDonald's. Payman tends the fryer. Netta assembles sandwiches.
Onion crispy. Yeah.
Crispy onion.
Crispy onion, yes. Bacon, cheese.
Payman jokes that he's put on a few pounds.
That's too bad for me.
Most days, like today, they work side by side. That way Payman can help Netta with her English. It's no coincidence they found this job. Lots of Iranians work here, says their manager, Mosh Zadeh.
Yeah, I have pretty much about 20 of them working for me.
All from Iran?
All from Iran, yes.
Yeah. Are you Iranian also?
I'm an Iranian as well, yes.
It's kind of a network.
It's kind of a network. I have about 14 of them working for other McDonald's as well.
He hires refugees from other countries, too. These jobs are a humbling step down for Netta and Payman. Zadeh sees that a lot.
I've had people that were engineers back home, for instance, but for now they had to work and hadn't have an income.
Netta and Payman earn about $10 an hour. Data show a refugee's income tends to steadily increase over time, but it's gotten tougher, and today's refugees are not making the same gains as those who arrived in the 80s and 90s. A recent study from the Migration Policy Institute suggests several reasons for this lag. The recent recession, an influx of new refugees with low education, and minimal levels of support for them upon arrival.
Hamburger patties.
Yes, hamburger patties.
Payman says he gets along well with his American coworkers, except this one time Another guy yelled at Payman for doing extra chores all the time. He said it made others look bad. That guy got fired after a couple weeks. And some customers get impatient with his English, so he practices in his downtime.
Hi, how are you? What do you do today? Oh, rain is coming.
It's a good job for now, but soon Netta will be home with the baby. Payman's income alone will not cover the rent. Something's got to change.
Too bad. I'm tired.
It's a hot Sunday afternoon, and I'm out at Payman and Netta's apartment in Kent. I think they've been up since about 8 a.m., packing boxes and just cleaning out their apartment.
7 months after they arrive, Netta and Payman are on the move. The last thing to pack up is a bonsai plant that Payman likes to talk to.
I say, I love you. You are simple of the life.
Where do you find this plant?
At the IKEA.
A friend helps carry the boxes to the parking lot. They've decided to move to Palm Springs for several reasons. It's sunnier, and Payman has cousins there who can help him find a better job. But a huge factor is the cost of living. Their new rent will save them a couple $100s a month. It's common for new refugees to relocate. Seattle's become a popular choice for the $15 minimum wage. Officially, this is called secondary migration, and some experts say it's an overlooked challenge in the resettlement process because people move around, but their support services don't. Payman is optimistic about what's ahead.
I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling excited. I hope I take a good job and maybe I will buy a home for my family. Not for me.
And in 5 years, he says, they can be citizens, Americans, not refugees.
Trunk is full?
Yes.
They'll drive south in an overstuffed gold sedan. A Ukrainian immigrant gifted them this car and said, pay me when you can. Payman says mostly they felt welcomed here, but there have been a couple odd encounters, and one happens now as they pack up. For nearly an hour, a young man with a shaved head stands 20 feet from the car, arms crossed, intently watching. We all just sort of ignore it, and the guy eventually leaves. It's sundown. The car is finally packed. Netta, 7 months pregnant, takes the passenger seat with a laundry basket on her lap.
Let's go.
Payman says goodbye to his friend and slides behind the wheel.
Bye.
It's a movie moment. There's a sunset, they're driving off, and an ice cream truck rolls by. Oh, and by the way, it's a baby boy. They name him Nathan. Nathan. In Kent, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
This story is part of a series this month about refugee resettlement called Upon Arrival. You can find photos, slideshows, and more stories at our website, KUOW.org. Netta and Payman are just two of the thousands of refugees who come to Washington State every year. What does that journey look like? State employee Sarah Peterson helps resettle refugees here. She told me the first step in the process is meeting the legal definition of a refugee.
A refugee is a person who has been forced to flee their home country because of a well-founded fear of persecution or because of persecution. And the legal definition requires that persecution to be based on one of five accounts, which are race, religion, ethnicity, membership in a particular group, or a political opinion.
We just had Donald Trump here in Everett talking about refugees, among other things, and saying we're letting people into America without enough vetting. So what is the screening process like to get into Washington State as a refugee?
So the U.S. refugee admissions process is completely administered by the federal government. It begins with a referral from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they refer a very small percentage of all refugees to the U.S. And they conduct a very extensive referral screening process that begins with a in-person interview from a Department of Homeland Security officer. And then it goes through a security clearance process where I am no expert on this process, but I understand that they go through many, many different databases to verify identity. For many, that process can be as quick as 18 to 24 months. For others, it can take years, if not decades, to get into the United States.
How much danger is there to the United States from refugees? And what can you do about that danger if it exists?
It is my understanding and in my experience working with refugees that many of these people are only looking to start their life over. Most of them never anticipated being able to come to the United States. And it takes years to get here. And the likelihood that you are able to come as a refugee is a little bit like winning the lottery. Less than 1% of all refugees worldwide ever even get selected for refugee resettlement. And the timeline it takes for people to come into the country is so extensive that it would be really difficult for someone who is intending to do harm to the U.S. to be able to come in.
How do we choose who wins that lottery?
It's a very complicated process, and it has to do a lot with our screening process, the exhaustive screening process that we do.
And but to even choose somebody to be eligible to win that lottery, it sounds so unlikely and so maybe arbitrary.
It is. It is very much arbitrary, and in the sense that you know, I think you have to meet first of all, you have to meet the legal definition. You have to be referred by the UN. And then you have to kind of go through the waiting process. And I do think that it is very selective and very specific. We've had people who have been forced to come separately because somebody in their family may have had a similar name to somebody in their home country, you know, that raised a red flag for security. And so they have to make a choice which part of the family gets to come.
Do you find refugees coming to Washington are affected one way or the other by this election year argument? And if so, how does it affect people?
That's a really good question. And I think that most refugees who have recently arrived within the last 2 to 3 years are probably so focused on resettling their own lives and finding a job, learning English, entering their kids in school, that they may not necessarily be aware of the rhetoric. I also think that Donald Trump's comments are not reflective in the welcoming community here in Washington State. The refugees that come to Washington State are partnered with American friends who volunteer with them. They're welcomed by religious communities, whether it's a church group or a mosque or a synagogue, where they help them along the way. So I think here in Washington State, we see that the refugees are embraced, and therefore, I think that the refugees are not necessarily hearing the same rhetoric that Donald Trump is speaking.
Sarah, you've said it is part of America's value system to help refugees. So what can somebody listening to this interview do toward that, if that's their goal?
Since I started working with refugees nearly 15 years ago, I have been really moved by the power and the resilience that refugees bring. I highly recommend anyone interested in getting involved in refugee resettlement to volunteer with a refugee resettlement agency or to volunteer with one of the many service providers that are there to help refugees.
What would they be volunteering to do?
It could be a variety of things. They could do something such as meet them at the airport for the first time when they're first landing in the U.S., which is so powerful and so moving. It could be that they're collecting in-kind goods. We've had church groups that put together baskets with laundry detergent and soap and different things that the refugees will need to create their life. It could be working with them one-on-one to teach them how to open a bank account or to practice their English so that they can have a job interview.
Some people are asking the Obama administration to increase the number of refugees that it accepts. Based on what you know, should there be an upper limit on accepting refugees?
I think that the United States has capacity to bring in large groups of refugees. And I think that the president is expected to set the cap for federal fiscal year 17, which begins in September, at 100,000 refugees. This is not close to the number of refugees that the U.S. brought in before 9/11. So I think that there is still room. My one caveat to that is I think that measured growth is needed in terms of making sure that the refugees are provided the proper services and supports once they arrive in the U.S.
Sarah Peterson is the refugee coordinator for Washington State's Department of Social and Health Services. Our series is called Upon Arrival, and it continues next week when we meet a young man from Somalia. Remember, you can find photos and more stories online at KUOW.org. Just look on the homepage up top where it says Upon Arrival. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. In the news today, Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson says he's going to propose a ban on assault weapons sales. Ferguson says assault weapons have no civilian use.
I am aware that there is no one piece of legislation that will stop a societal problem as big and complex as our epidemic of gun violence. But that should not paralyze us from doing what we can. Our proposal bans the sale of semi-automatic weapons with certain military-style features. That's number one. Number two, the bill prohibits the sale of large-capacity magazines capable of holding more than 10 rounds.
Ferguson made this announcement today alongside the parents of Will Kramer, who is the teenager who survived that mass shooting this summer in Mukilteo. Kramer's mother, Dr. Liz Raymond, said we need to quit selling assault weapons.
Because without a ban on these guns, there will be more mass shootings, like the one in Mukilteo that ended the lives of three beautiful, promising young students and injured our son.
Attorney General Bob Ferguson says he'll make his proposal this November if he is reelected. We've also reached out to his election opponent, Joshua Trumbull, to talk about this here on KUOW. 94.9 Seattle News and Information. After you have a brush with death, what do you do with your life? You could write a fable. That's what Seattle writer and musician Ken Boynton has done, a fable inspired by not one, but two near-death experiences. His first one was,
I got the flu, and then I got sicker, and inside of 2 days, I was in the ICU with complete kidney failure and sepsis, and they kept telling my wife that I was not going to survive. I got H1N1. And so that was about 8 or 9 days of I woke up after 4 days, sort of confused of why I'd been unconscious. So it left a lot of unanswered questions, but mostly 8 months of trying to recover enough to get through the day. I'd work for 20 minutes and then fall over and sleep for 3 hours. And 3 months later, we took a trip. We had been in Louisiana when this happened, and we'd come home, and then we took a trip to Los Angeles for something that my wife had to do. And on the way to the hotel, we got in a giant car accident on the 10 at high speed in our cab that went up on two wheels. And we fortunately came out of it without a scratch, although it was more traumatic for me because I was awake. So for a near-death experience, I think being unconscious is really the way to go. So then after that, it just changes you. It changes how you disagree with each other. It changes how you look at what you're doing. It changes the people that you want to hang out with.
Well, what did that look like for you, the changes?
You want to make sure every moment matters. And because Friday I was fine, Saturday I was a little bit sick, Sunday I never got out of bed, and Monday I was in ICU. So it happened so quickly, you realize I have no control over anything.
And you somehow wanted to communicate something to the rest of us.
Yeah, I don't know if I felt a responsibility. One of my friends said, because I write other things, I should do something with it. I don't know that I felt a responsibility to, but my own mind was surprising me with the things that it would think. It was going off and thinking things. And I started writing them down. And then I thought, well, maybe there's a book here or something. And I started to write it, and it was just horrible. It's very important to move through your life.
Yes.
And so I put it down.
I've learned the following things.
Yes. And you should internalize them. And I just stopped. And then I woke up one morning, and I thought, it's a fable. It'd be a fable.
It put me in the mind of Carl Sagan, who did that Pale Blue Dot. Oh, I guess it was the 70s. Every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization.
Yeah, that we're all from this little tiny. I love Pale Blue Dot. I hadn't heard it before. I've called it the tiny little golf ball suspended in blackness, or a little rock somehow floating in the vast emptiness of space.
There is a tradition in going to that image in one way or another, right? You mentioned it in your credits, I think, the Apollo 8 photos.
Yeah, that was the thing that did it for me as a kid, just thinking that image of the Earth. It was jarring because we didn't see the whole thing like you'd see it in a classroom. It was in shadow partially because obviously it would be. But we hadn't really thought that through. And I remember looking at it and thinking, oh, there'll be no more wars now.
You're not alone, though. Even astronauts have come away with that. They talk about that experience. So the book proceeds with eventually humans coming along onto this rock.
Yeah, the idea was really of the life of the Earth. The percentage we get to spend as individuals has to be a comically small number. And so I asked a mathematician friend, who said, this is what I'm looking for. I just know it's going to be 0.00000 something. And we did it for, I think, 70 years and for 100 years or something in there. maybe
good.
The early humans, you know, 40 years or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is. The numbers don't really vary that much. You know, it's a few decades of difference. But it's funny to look at and think of that and think that's all we have. We have that little tiny blip. And so that became, you know, the story of the Earth's life with us on it is sort of the first half of the book. And then it turns into a random person's
one of those humans
observations. One of 350,000 born on some particular day who grew up wondering about these things.
How do you live differently now?
Well, I'd like to say that it colors absolutely everything. And you go through life thinking, oh, we're all, you know, but I'm subject to the same frustrations everybody else is. I can't help thinking if we had a little bit more perspective that a lot of these things wouldn't happen. And that's a nice thing to hope for.
How can we lift our gaze?
I think if we reach out to find those perspectives, you know, I don't recommend near-death experiences for everybody. They're very unpleasant and hard to recover from. But we also, psychologically, as humans, we don't like to think about the fact that we're going to die. So I think part of what drives that intense frustration that we have, psychologists say, is because we have that intrinsic denial of our own demise that's coming. That's the thing all humans share. We know we're not going to get out of here.
Right. We're all headed toward the same exit. In fact, in the book, you get at the gift that mortality can be. This brevity, maybe the shortness of time, is what gives us some kick.
Well, that's what one of the people who reached out to me had studied Buddhism and said that that's a tenet of, and I haven't studied it, but he said that the tenet was the impermanence of life is what gives it its value. And I responded and said, that's amazing and beautiful, and thank you for sharing it. And then immediately responded, I'll go you one better. Achilles apparently said, the gods are jealous of us because they live forever, but we may be doing something for the very last time that we'll ever do it. And with that comes all this value and weight and that they can't touch because they don't have that mortality waiting for them. So I think the more we think about it, the less we worry about it. And the less we worry about it, the more we can find amazing things to do, you know, with those moments.
You hear that? Morbid people, there is nothing wrong with you. Big hug to the morbid people.
Yes. Here's a shout out to morbidity.
Ken Boynton's fable of life and questions in a short time on a tiny rock is called Blip. You can find it on Amazon. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Hey, welcome back to class. If your school district just reopened, here school's just getting started, and we're already learning stuff at KUOW. A few days ago, our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld, carried into the studio all of the first grade supplies required at one Seattle school. And I don't just mean binders and crayons.
Markers?
Yeah.
I couldn't find the washable kind, which are required. And then some things that you might not have brought to school when you were a kid, like three different sizes of Ziploc bags, a jumbo bag of napkins, two packages of hand sanitizer. Snack time rolls around. You need
Goldfish.
Goldfish. Blue masking tape. And here's my favorite.
Boom! That thump was two reams of computer paper. Those first grade supplies filled Anne's two backpacks and a plastic mail bin, and they cost about $100. Well, KUOW's social media producer, Bon Huberman, what did our listeners have to say about that?
There are a lot of comments on our Facebook page about this story, and people are kind of all over the map. So Erin, first of all, says she spent $175 between her second and fourth grader on supplies. Too much $! Meanwhile, Melissa's kids are in second and kindergarten, and they needed zero supplies. Then Megan's kindergarten list requires 30 glue sticks per student. She asks, will the class really go through 600 glue sticks in a year?
They do dry out.
Stephanie is the mom of an incoming fifth grader in Seattle, and she says she found most of her son's list for $27, and she has no problem with that. Quote, shop smart. Finally, Nancy says, we bought 96 pre-sharpened pencils for our third grader. That means one every 2 days of the school year. Nancy feels Target, Walmart, and Staples are cashing in on our schools being unable or unwilling to supply basic classroom needs for all students. Last but not least, we heard from someone who's been a teacher for a long time.
And for 30 years, I have been paying for all the supplies that the parents are now being asked to buy. What we generally do is the kids who don't have the money, we pool all the supplies together so the children don't know who has the supplies and who doesn't. And if parents are complaining, they should know that I have been buying Pura hand sanitizer and paper and all those supplies for 30 years. So this is nothing new, and I think it's fair that the parents chip in if the taxpayers are not willing to pay the taxes for it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a useful insight, too. Okay, today, first day of school, we learned the lesson that supplies are a burden on everyone, not just parents. Okay, listeners, one, two, three, ears on me. Remember, if you have something to say, you don't yell or hit. You just email us, record@kuow.org, or call our feedback line, 206-221-3663, 221-3663. And talk to us, Inside Voices. I'm glad you're here with KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle police got in trouble for using excessive force. Nationwide, you know the debate over why police keep shooting men of color. Now, a former Seattle police chief is proposing solutions. Norm Stamper was chief of police here for 6 years in the 90s. His book is called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. And we started out by talking about who becomes a cop. Stamper told me how he himself first got into policing with the best of intentions, but he was quickly changed by the culture.
Well, if I can use myself as an example, I became a cop with vaguely idealistic notions. I'm here to protect and serve. I'm here to help my fellow citizens. I'm not going to use the N-word. I'm not going to engage in unfair, unjust practices. In other words, I'm going to be a good cop who's behaving properly. And within a breathtakingly short period of time, my views about police work changed as a consequence of my association with police officers who'd been there for years.
What did police officers who'd been there for years tell you that changed you into a sometimes bad cop?
Well, the first and probably most important thing, and this is such a cliche in police circles, is that they told me to forget everything I learned in the academy. That's ivory tower stuff. That's probably coming right out of the chief's office, and you know how they are. And so if you're going to be a real cop, follow my lead. Racism, sexism, homophobia, all were very real for me in the ancient days of my rookie days as a police officer.
Real for you in your heart or the cops around you?
First of all, the cops around me were magnetic. They were humorous. I felt for the first time in my life I had a real family. Not to get too personal here, I came from an abusive home. My father was quite brutal. And in addition to physical abuse, he heaped a lot of emotional abuse as well. You're no good, you don't belong, so on and so forth. Then I become a cop, and suddenly I belong. And that's powerful stuff.
So it's family, it's belonging, but what does that have to do with being abusive to other people?
That's a really good question, and you know, I've done my level best to sort it out. Why would I transform myself from somebody who wanted to treat people with dignity and respect to someone who 5 minutes into the job is abusing the people he's been hired to protect and serve? So for me, the short answer is I liked what I saw among my fellow officers. I was drawn to it. That's not something that, you know, that most people would like to confess. But it was not very long before my badge grew heavy on my chest and the power went right to my head. I'd never had power in my life. Suddenly, I've got a lot of it.
Okay. Power, that's alluring.
It's pivotal.
We all know. Another element you talk about is fear.
Yes.
How afraid are police officers?
Some police officers are afraid, know they're afraid, and manage their fear. Those are the officers you want patrolling your beat, showing up at your home. Some officers are afraid and don't know it, and that's a lot of police officers. It may still be a minority, but it's a significant number of police officers who are driven by fear, which causes them to behave impulsively. Oftentimes what looks like anger, certainly presents as anger, is in fact fear. And when you hear a police officer screaming on, for example, one of these videotapes that we will see.
You mean the officer screaming at Mr. Castile, who he just killed?
Absolutely. That is one, I think, poignant and excellent example. Fear causes our perception to distort. And when that happens, we see threats that aren't there. We may miss a threat that is there. And so fear, no matter how you slice it, needs to be understood by every single officer in this country and managed by every officer.
Power, fear, those are two of the most important forces I can think of. How could we possibly take power and fear out of being police officers? You have a gun, you have camaraderie, you are put in scary situations.
And the short answer is we can't eliminate it. What we can do is provide quality instruction of the type generally that we're not providing today that will allow police officers to experience what their bodies go through when they're scared. Put them in a situation, 3 o'clock in the morning, darkened alley, they see a figure down at the other end of the alley, somebody taking out the garbage, or a hot prowler, and let them feel what it's like for their blood pressure to rise, for their vision to narrow and become tunnel-like. Let them experience the gift that is feedback from their own bodies. And let them experience it not just once and say, okay, we've done our session on fear, the physiology of fear. Let them experience that in a structured and safe environment that can be debriefed following those simulations throughout their careers.
But you have described how that's the kind of thing that cops tell each other, yeah, we had to sit in the training, but we're the warriors. Now we're going to do it the way it actually needs to be done. Which, doesn't that put some of the onus on the citizens? Because we treat police like mythologized warriors. We seem to want them to be that.
Well, I think you've raised for me a terribly important question, and that is, for whom do the police work? the police in America, in this country, belong to the people, not the other way around. If we engender an attitude among police officers that, hey, we're the cops and you're not, if we foster feelings of superiority or supremacy on the part of police officers, we've done exactly the wrong thing. Now, the culture will do that, has the power to do that. Citizens have far more power than they really believe they have when it comes to local policing. And I'm a very strong advocate of what I would call true community policing, not some cosmetic or PR version of it.
But, for example, citizens don't tell our warriors, our military, how to do their unfathomable jobs. How can we be grateful without glorifying and warifying our police?
First, let's do understand that military warriors are just that. They are trained to kill. They are trained to follow orders. Police officers are trained to make decisions, life and death decisions, peace and freedom decisions, crucial decisions that affect people's lives, including their own, in some cases, for the rest of their lives. And so if we can recognize and appreciate that cops make decisions for a living and soldiers follow orders for a living, we can begin to build a different kind of a relationship. Because that decision-making in a free and democratic society needs to be shared. It cannot be any longer unilateral, arbitrary decisions on the part of the police about what we're going to do in the area of crime prevention or stop-and-frisk practices or search and seizure and the like. And the community has a stake. It could be argued they have the biggest stake in those decisions.
So what would I'm listening to you now on the radio. I'm a community member. What's my role in this?
Get to know your neighbor to the left, to the right, and across the street. Talk about, if it's important to you, talk about police policies and police practices. Talk about your experiences or the experiences of family or friends. And organize and mobilize and say, if the police department does not invite you in to the decision-making, the policy-making process, then insist on that invitation. Insist on your voice being heard. That is what a free and democratic society is all about. And in the end, it will benefit tremendously police officers. When they treat the citizens as their partners, when they share information, they get information. It's called the rule of reciprocity. You're nice to me, I'm likely to be nice to you. If you give me information, I'll probably give you information. That's how human nature kind of works.
So we can't just complain, huh? We have to take some responsibility here.
I think, well, by definition, a hollow complaint is just that. If you're just complaining to hear yourself kvetch about something, that's not going to be helpful to the process. If what you're identifying is a systemic problem or a behavioral problem on the part of an individual officer, you may, by lodging that complaint, save that cop his or her job.
How much can all of this citizen responsibility defeat that culture we talked about in the beginning? We have power, fear, racism, psychological issues that you had, that human beings have, that police have. What are the odds we can change those interactions?
I stumbled upon a Nelson Mandela quote recently who, when he was told very early in his political agitation and organization and the like, this is impossible. This is utterly impossible. Do you know how deep the roots of apartheid go in this country? Do you realize how foolish is your dream? And he said, so it was impossible until it happened. And I'm absolutely convinced that people of goodwill, those in blue and those they are serving, working together can find common ground. There will always be unique idiosyncratic aspects of a workplace culture. I dare say you probably have those aspects here at KUOW. Everyone who's part of a workplace culture and grows up in that culture is going to have several, oftentimes competing views about, you know, what's right and what's wrong and how most effectively to get the job done.
I hate to be jaded, Norm, but I'm picturing you going in and having this talk in a precinct office in Baltimore or inner Chicago. I mean, aren't you an Orcas Island hippie? I mean, aren't you taking values from a place where it's easy?
Well, first, I've been called worse.
You know what I'm saying, though. Talking about culture here.
Yeah. I think the question is for police executives, for mayors, for other civic officials, for community activists, for anybody who perceives a need for change to learn how to treat people we disagree with that same dignity and respect we're asking of them. I think it's a leadership challenge for everyone who cares, regardless of position, official or otherwise. And I also think it requires schooling ourselves. Are there effective ways to communicate with people who disagree with us? Are there effective ways to influence the very people that we most want to influence? Or are we destined to just alienate them and give them all the ammunition they need to call us ivory tower characters or arbitrary and capricious administrators, that sort of thing? Labels don't help, but they're so common.
Sorry about the Orcas Island hippie label. I had to say it.
I'll wear it as a badge of honor.
Norm Stamper, wearing that badge. His book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. He's speaking tonight at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30. He and I also got into how policing is changing here in Seattle. Norm Stamper told me that he does see this city making progress with its federally required police reforms. You can hear our entire conversation at KUOW.org. At KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. Obamacare has taken some hits. Insurance companies have been pulling out of states' public health exchanges because they can't make any money there, which raises questions about how public our private health system can be. So it's interesting that Canada is now fighting over how its public health insurance is run. And some people think the result could be a health system that's more like America's. We need our Canadian correspondent here, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Good to talk with you again, Vaughn.
How private can our public system be is, I guess, to flip your sentence around.
Right, right. This is a court challenge we're talking about, Vaughn.
Yeah, a huge court case began in Vancouver this week, long anticipated. It's been years just coming to court. The central issue is whether or not the Canadian system, in order to maintain the public system, can severely limit access to private clinics and private insurance. The operator of one of the big private clinics in Vancouver, and there's only a few of them in all of Canada because of the restrictions, the operator of one of those big private clinics, Dr. Brian Day, is in court challenging these restrictions. He says, and his lawyer began the argument this week, is that it's cruel and unconstitutional. Canadians are being made to wait for health care when they could go to private insurance, jump the waiting list, and get pain managed, get their knees replaced, get their cataracts dealt with, instead of waiting for months, sometimes years, for care in the public system.
The defendant here is the BC Health Ministry. What does the government say?
Well, the provincial government says it's obliged by law and by federal cost-sharing arrangements to defend the public system, and so it is doing so. But I think it would be fair to say, Bill, that the provincial government hasn't exactly been in a rush to see this case get to court. It's taken about 8 years, and there's been a fair amount of stalling on the government side. So, I would say that the provincial government has turned a blind eye for a while to the exceptions that do allow some private clinics in the province. They've done it because it takes pressure off the public system and reduces some of the complaining about waiting lists. And, of course, the other thing you'd have to say about this bill is this case is set down for 6 months at BC Supreme Court level. Whatever the outcome, it will likely go all the way to the highest court in the country, the Supreme Court of Canada, and that could take another couple of years.
Defenders of Canada's public medical system basically accuse this man of trying to gut the core of the health system. What are the possible ramifications here, do you think?
You know, I think there's an awful lot of exaggerated rhetoric on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we would probably be headed for is the kind of system they have in most other countries, not the United States, but a lot of the European countries, where there's basic public system, but there's a second tier, as they call it, where people are able to jump the waiting lists and pay something and get private care dealt with. We do have some of that in Canada anyway, but it tends to depend on whether or not you're on a preferred list. If you're injured in the workplace and you're covered by workplace insurance, athletes jump the queue sometimes, healthcare workers, police officers, military, Native Canadians do. Prisoners and Canadian prisoners get care faster than ordinary Canadians sometimes. So that's one of the focuses of the case. It's that all these exceptions make the system very arbitrary and leave ordinary Canadians waiting for care or having to go to the United States and pay for care instead of being able to make use of a limited but reasonably available second-tier healthcare system, private, as exists in places like Australia, New Zealand, France, the UK, Germany, and so forth.
Would these changes to the Canadian system bring Canada a system based on ability to pay instead of based on need, which is kind of the core Canadian value?
Well, to some degree that's the case, Bill, but then you sort of go and look at some of these social democracies in Europe, and they all allow a measure of private care, publicly funded. They allow some queue jumping. We do too, as I said, but it's kind of arbitrary. So, I think there's a lot of exaggerated rhetoric on both sides. I think what we'd be looking at is some change in the system that would allow some private care, but I don't think you would gut the public health care system. I don't think you would discredit the idea of generally universal public health care. And I certainly don't think it would resemble the, shall I say, unusual combination of public and private that exists in the United States.
Yes, that is true. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer telling us about a case that will, sounds like, head to the Canadian Supreme Court and go on and on and on. We'll follow it. Vaughn, thanks a lot for filling us in.
Bye-bye, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You know, most people are trying to avoid Florida mosquitoes, blamed for dozens of cases of the Zika virus. Well, Republican Congressman David Jolly today decided to make a point by bringing a jar of the mosquitoes to the House floor. A closed, clear container of mosquitoes of the type that carry the Zika virus. His office said they're in the larva stage, but they're expected to hatch today.
Can you imagine, colleagues, the fear and anxiety in this chamber if these 100 mosquitoes were outside this jar, not inside this jar? Members of Congress would run down the hall to the physician's office to be tested. They would spray themselves before coming down here. This is the fear of Floridians, right here.
Jolly condemned Congress for not passing legislation providing $1 billion to fight the Zika virus. The bill is stalled in the Senate, where Democrats are blocking it in a dispute over restrictions on Planned Parenthood. We'll get more into this story this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Get a podcast of KUOW's The Record on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for joining us.